G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, mate.
G'day. I'm going to miss hearing that.
Yeah, that's right. We're at chapter 42 of Job.
I can't believe that. I was trying to figure out over the last couple of days when we actually started.
Wow, that's a good question. Has it been about, I'm guessing it's been over 6 months. Would that be right?
It's got to be way over 6 months.
Yeah, we've been going at this for a while. We've finally reached the end.
Chapters, 42 chapters, and we've only done maybe, I don't know, half a dozen or so. We've done double chapters.
Yeah.
So it might be, you know, closer to like 3/4 of a year.
There's been a couple of weeks where we had to take a break, but we've persisted through it, and maybe it's been closer to a year. So thank you to the listeners who have listened all the way through this series, and we hope that you've benefited from it and that it's blessed you and that it's opened up new things that you haven't considered before. That's always a joy for us when that happens. And let me take the opportunity, Ira, to say thank you to you for giving so much of your time, an enormous amount of time, a huge amount of time to this program, Treasures from the Tanakh.
No, I appreciate the opportunity to be heard. And, you know, I was talking to our friend Yoel last week or 2 weeks ago about this. And still couldn't believe that I took on the task of Eov, the book of Job.
Because it's not the easiest book in the Bible, right?
No, it's not. And, you know, look, it's actually probably the hardest book because there's so much of the Hebrew that we really have no idea. You know, we're basically pulling at straws with certain areas of the Hebrew because some of it is so old. It's kind of like, if we continue on at some point in the other book that we talked about doing, which we'll just tease them a little and won't tell them just yet. But here's a hint. The hint is that it's another one of those difficult books. And why is it difficult? Because where this has a lot of very poetic Hebrew and a lot of Hebrew that's so old that we really, you know, are just guessing as to what it means. You know, in this other book, there's a lot of Aramaic. Yoel and I were talking about that neither one of us are really that well versed in, you know, Aramaic. So it should be a challenge.
So you've narrowed it down. We have spoken about possibly in the future, when time allows, doing another book and from the Tanakh. And I don't mind saying, Ira, and this might shock a lot of people, if I could have a least favorite book in the Tanakh, that would be the one.
Right, but you know what? Those are the ones that I always, not necessarily that I would read, but those are the ones that I like doing on a show like this. Because what it does is it challenges me. You know, going through this last, you know, whatever it is, 9 months to a year that we've gone through the book of Job has been great for me because it's opened up this, you know, this book to me in a new way. It's forced me to really go in to study this and to study verse by verse and to look at some of the, you know, look at some of the Hebrew and try to break down some of the roots and see other perspectives, which I've tried to present here, not saying that we know for certain that this is what these things mean, but giving different perspectives. And as a matter of fact, I have one tonight that, you know, really came to me in studying this last chapter, something that I've never thought about. And that's why I agreed to take on a book like Job. And that's why we're talking about that other book that you would rather not ever read again.
To be fair, Ira, it's probably because, in fact, I'm sure a large part of it has to do with what the tradition where I came from, what they have done with this book is so nauseating. It's just by association, the book now by association reminds me of some of the idiotic and crazy and far-fetched speculation that the tradition that I came from has done to the book that we're thinking about doing. Look, we may get there, we may do it, and time will tell, as Keith says. But look, Job is the same. So much that we have dealt with in Job was controversial because of what the Christian tradition has done to the book that just doesn't stand up in the Hebrew.
Right. And so, you know, when we talk about books like this, you know, of course, we come from different traditions. And even though I might have sojourned outside of what would be considered traditional Judaism, and now I'm back, I have the advantage over somebody like you. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, I have the advantage over somebody like that came from the Christian tradition, like you did, knowing what the Jewish perspective was coming into this. Like, I knew what the Jewish perspective was, even though I might have strayed away from what's considered normative Judaism and then came back, at least I always had that with me. So when you look at certain books like this, you're really not coming into it. You may be coming into a little bit, but not to the extent that you did. So kind of having that foundation of knowing what the Jewish perspective is on books like this makes it a little bit easier to not really get caught up in a lot of that craziness where books like this are taken and used to promote a particular agenda rather than looking at it. Look, the bottom line is that, you know, I love that even the Talmud talks about the fact that nothing overcomes Peshat. Nothing overcomes the simple meaning of the text. Yes, we have Midrash and we have different levels of interpretation. But even from a Jewish perspective, the first thing that we do is we look at the simple meaning of the text. We don't say, okay, well, let's look at the underlying meaning. Let's look at the sod level or the deeper mystical interpretation. No, let's look at what the simple meaning of the text is and go from there. Mm. And that's what we're trying to do. That's what you've done with Truth to You. And this is what we who have come in, the teachers like myself and like, you know, Nehemiah and Yoel and Keith and others that come in and Jason and so forth are just looking to do that. We've all said, let's go back and let's look. We already know. We already know, or we've been taught all these other things. Mm. Now let's go back and say, you know what? Let's turn over a new leaf and say, let's look at it without that. Let's see what the simple truth is, what the simple meaning of the text is, and go with that and see where that leads us.
Let's first attempt to understand what it meant to the original audience before we go on with all the mystical bits and pieces and deeper meanings and Aleph Tavs and all those sorts of things. Okay, sure. So it begins like this in chapter 42. Now, this is straight after chapter 40, 41, obviously, Yehovah speaks to Job in a very assertive way and challenges him, even with a hint of sarcasm, and questions him and really draws to his attention the magnificence, the incredible power of Yehovah, as indicated by some of his creation that he just points out to Job. And then Job answered Yehovah and said in verse 42, chapter 42, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Please, listen, please, let me speak. You said, I will question you and you shall answer me. And I have heard you by the hearing of my ears, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, he's already in dust and ashes, Ira. What's going on there?
Yeah, except he, you know, I mean, look, I spent 41 chapters giving a kind of different perspective on the way people look at Job. And people could either accept it or not accept it. But one of the perspectives that I brought up was the fact that, you know, Job was out of order. And clearly he comes to the realization after having been confronted by God. And of course, you know, all of this, you know, the first speech that we hear from God comes in chapter 38. And this is what he's quoting now. Some of the things that were said in chapter 38 and going forward that God said to him, you know, where he's just repeating what had already been said as far as, you know, who is it that darkens counsel? You know, because that's, you know, that's what the Hebrew says. And so there's that perspective that that even though he's gone through all of this suffering and that somehow he didn't deserve to suffer because we see he was an Ish Tam, he was, you know, a righteous man, that somehow he had the right to do what he was doing and say the things that he was saying. And he comes to the realization. Now, what's really interesting, okay, is in the second verse and the third verse that we see. Okay, and it's very subtle. And if you don't really pay attention to what you're reading, you can miss it. Okay, what does he say? He says, I know that you can do all things. I know. Those are the first things he says. I know. I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours is impossible or can be thwarted. You know, that word can mean impossible too there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see him re-quoting what God has said already. Who is it that darkens counsel without knowledge? Then he says this, therefore I have declared what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. So first he says, I know. Then he says that I didn't understand. So we kind of have this, what do you mean, Job? One verse you say, you know about God, you know all of the things that can't be thwarted. And then the next thing you're saying, you don't understand. So it looks like we have a contradiction here. And I think for me, what jumps out about this is, and it certainly speaks to anybody today in any faith system that has a relationship with the creator of the universe, that there's a vast difference between intellectual apprehension and the balance between the heart and the intellect. And I think we discussed this a few weeks ago when I talked about one of the fundamental distinctions between Judaism and Christianity. And that being the difference between going solely by the heart. We talked about the fact that we can't go simply by our heart feelings, and mm-hmm. we can't go simply fully by our intellect either. You know, mm-hmm. there are people that will say, oh, you Jews, all you do is go with head knowledge. And on the other hand, there are people that we look at that we say, well, all you do is go by blind faith. All you do is go by your heart. And what we're saying is in Judaism, and not just in Judaism, this shouldn't be just for Jews. This is for the entire world. This is for anybody who wants to have a relationship with the creator of the universe. It should be that we should find the balance between our intellect and our heart. So we find a balance between knowledge and emotion. And I think what's being said here is that intellectual apprehension by itself is useless. Like the fact mm-hmm. that you know in your head that there's a God and you know that God does all these things is useless to you, as Job finds out. And this is why we then see him going further. Now, when he says in verse 5, to elaborate on this a little bit, he says, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. So if we go further and elaborate on verse 3, it's that before he had an intellectual apprehension of who God was, but now he understands, not just intellectually.
Before he had an intellectual understanding, now he has an experiential understanding.
Exactly.
And the two do not conflict. Is that fair?
That's fair, because now he's able to not just hear, because one of the things that we can make of verse 5 is that really what's saying is, what Job could be saying is, I've heard of your fame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've heard about you. I've heard about all the things that you do. I've heard about what a great God you are. But now he's saying, I don't just hear now. I see with my own eyes.
When he says, I see with my own eyes, what you have just described is what he is conveying. He's not actually saying, I see you visibly, and now I know that you're actually there. He's not saying that. He's not talking about a physical representation of God before him, is he?
No.
Very good. Just wanted to clear that up.
No, not
and
at all.
So,
that's the point. He's now having this, he's now come into a balance where he's not just basing his understanding on having heard about this God, but now he's experienced this God as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so it continues on, and I'm going to return to that parts of what you said, Ira, as I continue on a little further. We're going to be going to Deuteronomy, but verse 7, and so it was after Yehovah had spoken these words to Job that Yehovah said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now, how do we understand that? If we're to understand that there are flaws in what Job has said, yet here Yehovah is saying that Job has spoken what is right, as opposed to Eliphaz and his two friends.
Well, I think really when we look at that verse, we have to break it down between the two, and of course that's what you're asking me to do. So when we look at Job, for instance, and all of the things that Job has said, we've made mention of the times that Job has sought to bring God before the bar, so to speak, you know, in the courtroom. Like, I want to stand, you know, as an adversary against God and hear my case heard. However, in his moments of lucidity, he has always spoken about God in a positive manner. Whereas the friends basically, how would I say this? When the friends maintained throughout the argument that the only thing that Job needed to do was repent because he was sinful in this.
Because he was sinful and therefore God has punished him for being sinful. And, right. and there's an accusation about God in that as well.
Right. So what there is there's a question of the justice of God. And I think that's what caused God's anger to burn against Eliphaz and the friends, in that by the statements that they made, they questioned God's justice and mm-hmm. whether or not he really is a just God.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Verse 8. Now this is very curious. Now, therefore, take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams. Go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So that's repeated again. But 7 bulls and 7 rams, Ira.
Yeah.
Now this takes me to Numbers chapter 23. This is it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the only place that we see 7 bulls and 7 rams. So Numbers chapter 23, this is, of course, Balaam's first prophecy. And in fact, I'll go from 22 verse 41. And so it was the next day that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, that from there he might observe the extent of the people of Israel, of course. Then Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams. And so it goes on, and he receives an oracle and speaks a blessing over Israel. But we see it there. We don't see it anywhere else, and it's not exactly the kind of offering that we would expect to see according to Leviticus. What do you make of it?
Well, we do see it one other place.
Do we?
Yes.
Do tell.
We see it in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 26. It says, since God helped the Levites who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, they sacrificed 7 bulls and 7 rams.
So they did. How about that? So this appears 3 times in the Tanakh.
It actually appears 4 times. Numbers 23:1, Numbers 23:29, Job 42:8, and 1 Chronicles 15:26.
So Balaam does it twice.
Right. Well, yeah. Okay. It's, in Numbers 23, it's the same thing being said again.
Now, bulls are generally, we understand from Leviticus, the bulls are a sin sacrifice for either the high priest or for the people in general. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this case,
which makes it interesting in Job.
It makes it very interesting, because do we think that their sin was so incredibly huge that they needed 7 bulls to cover 3 guys? I don't know, but we did discuss early in the program, we established the possibility that Job was seen as had some kind of king status, if not also a priestly status as well.
Right.
And we do know that his 3 friends also were leaders of the people from where they came. Perhaps they were also considered as some form of king or priestly status too. Therefore, is this very much out of line? Is it unusual? Is it rather appropriate?
Well, I mean, the thing that pops out to me in what you're talking about is the priestly status, is that it's very clear to me that God has Job acting as a Kohen, you know, in this situation. And what pops out for me is the fact that that in a way I see this as much for Job as I see it for the friends, even though obviously it's being spoken of about the friends needing to have this. But there's an action required on Job's part. You know, one of the things that we see when sin sacrifices were brought often was that the person bringing it would have to lean their hands upon the animal, just mm-hmm. like we see the Kohen HaGadol in Vayikra 16 in Leviticus with the Yom Kippur sacrifice, where he would lean the hands on the animal, on the goat for Azazel, and place the sins of the people upon it. We see in Leviticus in some of the early chapters that this was true as well, that the individual would go and lean their hands on the animal that they were bringing. So it required an action on Job's part as well. And so I see this as kind of having a dual fulfillment. One for the friends, obviously, for their atonement for having sinned against God, but it required, again, not just the intellectual apprehension that Job was wrong, and not just a verbal repentance, but there was a requirement for him to have an action as well. Even though he wasn't bringing the sacrifices for himself, he was still involved in the process, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he was restored after he prayed for his friends. But something occurred to me, Ira, and perhaps you might have an opinion on this. Perhaps also the reason why he was restored after he prayed for his friends was also for the sake of the friends, that they experienced the humility of having someone pray for them whilst still in such a lowly state, the state that they ridiculed him for.
Oh, there's no question. I absolutely believe that that took place. There's no question that the attitude that they took against him, in the sense that they almost felt like he should be seeking them to intercede for him, that this whole thing was turned around on them, and instead God said, no, you need my servant Job to intercede for you in order to, you know, to have my wrath be removed, you know, this whole process. It didn't just require the sacrifices. Again, it required, you know, Job's prayer as well for his friends.
And a very humbling experience for them, no doubt. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Sophar the Naamati, is that right? Naamathite, went and did as Yehovah commanded them, for Yehovah had accepted Job.
Mm-hmm.
He'd accepted Job. Now what does it say? Because in verse 10, as we mentioned, Yehovah restored Job's losses, or his captivity, I think is what it says in the Hebrew, when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, Job, Yehovah gave Job twice as much as he had before. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But what does that say about prayer?
Oh, this is one of the most significant verses for me in this, part of, especially this time of year for me, okay, mm-hmm. In Judaism, we're in this period of Elul, okay? And in the period of Elul, coming up to the Chagim, Yom Teruah, or what we call Rosh Hashanah, and Yom HaKippurim, and especially the days between Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur, called Yamim Noraim, the days of awe, the 10 days of awe. Mm-hmm. This whole process for us is about slichot, forgiveness, this idea of seeking God for forgiveness. Trusting in the mercy of God. And I think that this is really significant that we're talking about it right in the midst of this, you know, that we're getting ready very soon for Yom Teruah, and this idea of preparing ourselves to stand before the King, that we see this verse, that we see that in a situation like this, when people have wronged us, as they have, that there is this requirement for us to pray, to not only fall upon the mercy of God for those transgressions which we have transgressed against the instructions of the Creator, but even those who have hurt us, those people that have come against us, that rather than attacking and rather than reacting, that we become proactive, and proactive, you know, sends us towards prayer. And hopefully God would have mercy on us through that and restore to us our place before Him and restore those people as well.
But in addition to that, Ira, it certainly seems, because Yehovah says, "For I have accepted Job, you will go to him and you will ask him to pray for you to me, because I won't deal with you lest my wrath fall upon you. But if you go to Job, because I have accepted him, I will hear him." Now, we know we read something like this in, Proverbs chapter 28, verse 9, if I remember correctly, that says, "One who turns away his ear from hearing Torah, even his prayer is an abomination."
Right.
So, are they going to Job as one who is righteous, as one who is blameless, a servant of God, someone who God has accepted, so that they may petition him to ask him to mediate, in a sense? I mean, we see that role fulfilled by Moses for both Aaron. We see an example of that, or we read about it a little later after the event of the golden calf. Also for the people of Israel on a number of occasions, that he intercedes on their behalf and speaks for them. Why? Because he is accepted by God.
Right. So as a matter of fact, I just wrote a piece up that I just posted on Facebook probably about an hour ago or an hour and a half ago on that very subject. And what I wrote about was the challenge that we place before God. And people like look at me like I'm crazy when I say that we have the ability to challenge God in these days. Mm-hmm. And the example that I use is what you just brought up, is Moshe challenged God, even though he knew that B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, had sinned without excuse, that they had no excuse for their sin, whether it was Daniel Zahav, the golden calf, that he challenged God and he had the faith. His faith was in the mercy of God, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's why I was bringing out what I was bringing out, this idea of Job's needing to pray for them is twofold. Is one, what you're talking about, we already talked about the fact that obviously God wanted to humble them, you know, and have them come before him or come before Job in that sense and allow Job to be the one that prayed for them and interceded for them. And like I said, a lot of it has to do with Job being involved in this process as well, because mm-hmm. I don't think that God would have been happy with Job if Job walked away from the whole thing saying, well, great, I knew it all along that I was justified and these guys were wrong. I think that this was part of the process for Job as well.
Sure, absolutely. So now getting back to verse 10 and what you were saying earlier on, verse 10 says that Yehovah restored Job's losses or Job's captivity when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, Yehovah gave Job twice as much as he had before.
But did he really get twice as much?
We're going to talk about that. But
we are going to talk about that.
before we do. Now, you remember at the beginning of the program, we speculated as to when was this written. Is this, in fact, perhaps the oldest book of the Bible? Is it possible that Solomon wrote it? Is it possible that it's written allegorically to represent Israel itself? And I wanted to go to, if I may, Deuteronomy chapter 29 and on. I just want to read this, and I'll leave this for the listeners to ponder. Let's go from verse 27 of Deuteronomy 29. I'm just going to read on. Then the anger of Yehovah was aroused against this land to bring on it every curse that is written in the book, and Yehovah uprooted them from their land in anger and in wrath and in great indignation and cast them into another land as it is this day. The secret things, Ira, the secret things belong to Yehovah our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this Torah. Now, that goes a little in hand with what you were saying earlier on with the beginning of this chapter, with things that Job knows and things that he doesn't understand and things that he doesn't know. The secret things belong to Yehovah.
That was always one of my favorite verses.
It's a great verse. I love that verse.
And it could be used in a powerful way like we just did. But, of course, people would come up to me, and if I didn't have an answer, I would say Deuteronomy 29:29.
There you go.
Or 29:28 in the Hebrew Bible.
And as I said, what we do know about God, what we understand intellectually about God, the truths that we understand should not conflict with our experience. And in this case, we understand that the secret things belong to him, but those things which are revealed, things that are revealed to us, are for us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of the Lord. Now, it goes on to say, now it shall come to pass, when all these things come upon you, the blessings and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among the all the nations where Yehovah your God drives you, and you return to Yehovah your God and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all your heart and with all your soul, that Yehovah your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where Yehovah your God has scattered you, if any of you are driven out to the furthest parts under the heaven, from there Yehovah your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you. And Yehovah your God will bring you to the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. And he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers, and Yehovah your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love Yehovah your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. I have to keep going, Ira. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is just such a great passage.
I'm reading along with you.
Verse 7, also Yehovah your God will put all these curses on your enemies and on those who hate you, who persecute you, and you will again obey the voice of Yehovah and do all of his commandments which I command you today. Yehovah your God will make you abound in all the works of your hand, in the fruit of your body, in the increase of your livestock, in the produce of your land for good. For Yehovah will again rejoice over you for good as he rejoiced over your fathers if you obey the voice of Yehovah your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which are written in the book of the Torah and if you turn to Yehovah your God with all your heart and with all your soul. That's up to verse 10 of Deuteronomy chapter 30. And it really did...
Oh, no, you can't stop there.
Okay, do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, you got to read the next couple of verses.
For this commandment, which I command you today, is not too mysterious for you, Ira. It's not far off. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven and bring it down to us, that we may hear it and do it. Nor is it beyond the sea that we should say, who will go over the sea for us to bring it to us, that we may hear and do it. But the word is very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. Do you want me to keep going?
No.
That'll do?
No, that'll do. I mean, there it is. It's not in heaven that somebody has to bring it down for us. It's not in the sea. It's right there in your heart and in your mouth.
Amen. Amen. And just when I read particularly verse 10 of Job 42, it just reminded me of the speculation that the book of Job may be allegorically speaking of Israel, also prophetically as well. And the restoration of Job could be paralleled to the coming restoration of Israel, and may it be today. And I tell you what, there's a lot of chess pieces that seem to be in the appropriate place at the moment, Ira.
That's very possible. Well, let's talk about that word that we see in Deuteronomy and in Job 42. It says, "Varonai shav et shivit," or it's a little bit different. It's shavut in some and it possibly, I didn't look at the codex to see if there's a Masorah on this, but there might be, because there's a question as to how that should appear, because in the other places it appears with the vav there. In that word, and you use the word captivity.
Yes.
And so typically when you look at the English translation, it says, and the Lord restored, the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friend, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. But when you read it in its, when you read it literally, and the Lord restored captivity, okay, when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before, we have a very interesting, for me, there's a very interesting possibility here. Who was he captive to? And that we would have to go back to the very beginning of the book when we first started talking about this other character that was part of the divine council, the guy with the horns and the tail and the fork. And so for me, that's a very interesting use there of the fact that it's used captivity. Because if we're to understand that in Job chapter 1, that God says, I want to say in verse 10, and I may get there in a verse or two, in Job chapter 1, I think it's in verse 10, where it says that God gives Job over to the Satan and says, I place him into your hand, but you can only go so far, you can't touch him, okay? So to a certain extent, he was captive to that messenger who had a specific purpose to fulfill according to God. And yet God is now saying that as a result of this process and a result of him praying for his friends, that he was released from that captivity. So I think that's very interesting. And I'm going to go further into this as we move on.
Let me offer another perspective as well in regards to this, in regards to the word captivity. Could it be that which was captive from him, not that he himself was held in captivity, but that so much of his possessions were...
Ah, very good. So that's where we're going next.
Now, the reason why I go there, can I go to back to the Torah and go to Exodus chapter 22?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because what it says is in verse 4, I think, is where I'm going. If the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall restore double. And though his sons and daughters were killed, remind me, Ira, was not his livestock carried away? I don't think it was killed. Just let's see if we can confirm that.
So here's the question. You know, I don't know if I want to go there yet, but you're challenging me. You said we know that his sons and daughters were killed. How do we know that?
Oh, we don't know that?
Well, how do you know that?
Well, because the little subheading on my New King James study Bible tells me so. What do you mean?
Where does it say? So what?
I've got a subheading that adds to the Bible.
I know what the verse says, but I'm
okay. So
challenge you a little bit.
So in chapter 1, verse 13, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.
Uh-huh. So how do we know?
Well, that's a good point.
Who told him?
Wait.
How does Job find out that his sons and daughters were killed?
Well, it seems like one servant was saved alive.
You used a word. No.
Servant?
No. Go back. So verse 13?
Verse 13. Okay, so let me go back. I have to turn the page. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house.
And what next?
And a messenger. It was an angel.
It was a
with white fluffy wings.
So, no.
And a little halo on top.
So let's discuss this a little
That's
bit.
That's what it was?
Let's discuss this.
Beams of light and a choir behind going, ah.
So let's go with my perspective for a minute.
Go on.
Just humor me, okay? If the word captivity there in verse 10 of Job 42 can refer to the possibility that in Job chapter 1 in the early verses that God turns over Job to the Satan, who is also a malach, a messenger, is it not possible that this messenger that came and told him that was sent from Satan?
Well, if this messenger was sent from the messenger Satan, or the messenger acting as a Satan,
right?
Then is that messenger also not sent by Yehovah, as only messengers act in the authority of Yehovah?
No, absolutely. So here's the reason why I asked you the question. When you said that double was restored to him, I said, was it really? Because the only thing he received back double was what? His livestock.
Sure. And this is my point. Is it not the livestock that went into captivity while his sons and daughters were killed?
Right. But what I'm saying is there's the possibility that none of them were killed.
All right. I have to keep reading. Can I keep reading?
That's the point I'm trying to bring up is that he didn't receive now 14, you know, he didn't receive double the amount of sons and double the amount of daughters.
But there is another possibility there as well. But let me keep going. I'm just going to read. I'm going to continue in Job chapter 1.
All right.
It says, while he was still speaking, another came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep.
Right.
Oh, burned up the sheep.
Right, right. No, I knew the sheep were burned up.
So the sheep are not taken
into captivity.
But how
did he find out that the sheep were burned up?
Another messenger came. Lo and behold. While he was still speaking, another came. Another messenger. Now, I've always assumed, Ira, why did you wait until the end of the book to tell me this? I don't think we addressed it in chapter one because we were talking about the Satan. But another messenger came while he was still speaking, verse 17, and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away. Now, the camels are taken into captivity and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine with their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead.
Yes.
Now, there's no question about it.
What do you mean there's no question about it?
I alone have escaped to tell you. Now,
Let me ask you a question. If you were, here we are in the modern day today, okay? Would this information hold up in a court of law? We talked about a divine counsel. This is evidence that's being brought. Somebody comes and says, oh, you know, by the way, this happened. And it's a malach, a messenger that comes. We already know that he's been turned over to a messenger, okay, who now can do with him what he likes as long as he doesn't touch him, right? We come to this conclusion on our own that somehow this just means that it happened. And what I'm doing is I'm positing the possibility that none of this actually happened.
Okay, there's a theory that I haven't considered, but I have to question whether we are talking about a malach of Yehovah, because it does say that it seems to be fairly straight that that the children have died, and it says, as the other cases, I alone have escaped to tell you. Four cases it says that. Now, if the messenger is saying I alone have escaped to tell you, it sort of suggests that they too were at the sharp end of the stick as well. And
what does that mean? It doesn't tell us that Job knew this person or that they were his servants. We just don't know. We don't have that. We just have someone coming and telling him a story. So I'm not saying again that that's 100%. I'm just saying that I don't think anybody's ever brings that up, the possibility.
That's true. Well, I've never heard that before. So let's keep that in mind as we continue reading, because there is another theory as well. And verse 11 says, then all his brothers and all his, this is after Yehovah gave Job twice as much as he had before, then all his brothers and his sisters and all those who had been acquaintances before came to him, ate food with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that Satan had brought upon. Oh, wait a minute. It doesn't say Satan, Ira. That's not what it says. It says they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that Yehovah had brought upon him. Each one gave him a piece of silver and each one a ring of gold. Now,
Where were these people before?
I know. Where were they before?
Where were they before? Now, suddenly, you know, it's like, the guy gets, you know, double back of everything. We don't hear about it yet, but now he's wealthier than he was before, and now everybody's coming to the house to eat with him and tell him, oh,
his brothers and sisters, no less, Ira. Brothers and sisters and acquaintances.
Now they're sitting, where were they when he was in the trash heap?
I don't know, but it's a question that has to be asked. We can only speculate, but it's a question that has to be asked. Verse 12.
Skin from his body while worms were crawling all over.
Yeah, him. I know. Thank you.
I know. I had to bring that up. At least one.
Now, Yehovah blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, for he had, now here we go, he had 14,000 sheep. Now, there's a good point. We just read that the sheep were burnt up, and so it's not as if the sheep went into captivity and he's been restored twice as much as it is indicated in Leviticus, so we can write that off as a possibility. However, the camels were taken away, 6,000 camels. He has now 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 female donkeys. He also had, this is what you're pointing out, 7 sons and 3 daughters, but he started with 10 children. Now he has 10 children, and I've heard some say, Ira, is this an indication of a resurrection?
As we said with the book of Job, we can never be sure, but I'm sticking with the fact that the reason that his 10 children were restored to him was because they never died. And I think that this can speak to a lot of different ways that we view this book in the fact that it does speak to us in many different ways. It does speak to us at the potentially as to how God deals with the nation of Israel. It can speak to us about how God deals with those who suffer. It can speak to us in many different ways. And so that's why I bring up these different perspectives. I like this idea that he received double because this is very scriptural, but at the same time, he received back the same number of children. I don't think that suddenly he had, as a matter of fact, he even received double back his life. Because when we see this further down, it says he lived 140 years, and we know that typically 70 years is the years of man. Mm. And he lived 140 years after this, so he received double for that, but he only received the same number of children. So I'm sticking with the fact that these were the same children, and he found that really the part of the...
Oh, look, I'm not saying that...
I'm not arguing either. I'm just saying that part of the captivity of Satan having him in his hand was making him believe that he had lost everything. And instead, he really didn't lose everything. That was part of the captivity that then was restored to him.
Now, speaking of restoration, do you believe that there will be a resurrection of faithful Israel?
How could I not believe in a resurrection?
Would that then include Job's children, the children that died?
Well, you're asking me to make the assumption that his children died, and I'm making
if they did.
So that is a really tough question, because the question is whether or not Job was actually part of Israel.
But are we not talking about a man who is a servant of God, as Israel is often described, a man who is blameless and upright before God, a man who Yehovah refers to as someone who has done what is right and blessed him in his latter days? Why would he not be included in the
covenant? No, I'm just saying, you know, there's some question as to that, you know, based
on... Let's continue to hypothesize and say that he is included in that covenant. Would not his children be? Now, I'm just saying, if we imagine that Job's children are restored when Yehovah restores all things,
right?
Then does he not have twice as many children?
Okay.
Now we're hypothesizing, but yeah, it is a theory.
Ezekiel 37 talks about, you know, resurrection. So obviously there's going to be a resurrection. Mm-hmm. It's a very fundamental, you know, foundational principle in Judaism. So Judaism is not against the resurrection.
Hmm.
So yeah, I guess if we go with the assumption that his children died, and he had 10 more children, then yes, in the resurrection he would have 20. However, the resurrection...
Because we're not expecting a resurrection of livestock, Ira, are we? We're not.
Right, but the point is that in a resurrection of, you know, from a Jewish perspective, in Ezekiel 37, the resurrection is going to be for the Olam Haba, not for the Olam Hazeh. It's not like, you know, it's not like the Christian concept of, you know, heaven on earth and, you know, you're going to be the prince of a city and you're going to be in a glorified body and I'm not making any
suggestion like that. I'm basing it on what is suggested in the Tanakh. But I tell you what, though, Ira, should that be the case, I would love to see Job there.
No, I would too. But what I'm saying is that when you talk about the concept of him having double the number of children, it's a different kind of concept in the resurrection. Mm-hmm. It's not like he's now going to be resurrected and, you know, he's going to have the 10 more kids move into his house. He's going to have to build an addition on, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure. That's
what I'm trying to say.
So it's interesting to consider. So there's a number of possibilities. And so he called the name of the first Jemima. And the name of the second was Keziah. And the name of the third, Keren Hapuk. Now, listen, that's interesting that we should... why do you think all of a sudden we have a verse dedicated? In fact, two verses. Because it goes on to say, in all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job. And he gave their... and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. Why do we all of a sudden have two verses highlighting the daughters? Not that we shouldn't, but it's unusual.
Yeah. Well, you may not like my answer because you don't like when I give Job a hard time. But at the end of the book, so I'm going to give Job a little bit more of a hard time.
Oh, no.
I think one of the things that we learn, one of the things that I brought up about Job throughout our study, you know, and certainly we talked about it tonight, is this intellectual apprehension. I talked about him, that we talked about the possibility of him being a king and so forth, being full of himself, talking about how he took care of the poor and he took care of all these different people and so forth. The question is, and I also brought up this point at the very beginning, that he would bring sacrifices for his children, that they were always having parties. You know, we talked about them having these, you know, the mishteh, always they were having a feast, you know, at one of the houses with the daughters there as well. So the question is, what kind of father really was Job? Okay, how much was he really invested into his children, other than the fact that he brought, I mean, they were always at parties. How much was he involved in their lives?
And to be fair, we did speculate onto the wholesomeness of those parties, but to be fair, we don't really know the nature of those, and whether it was the source of their downfall as some sort of judgment.
No,
but it's a possibility.
No, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that if he was the kind of father that was so busy with his whatever duties he had, a leader, being the guy in the gates of the elders, and everybody looked up to him, and he was out there pontificating and taking care of the poor. Look, we see this all the time, that men of great wealth and great power often have much more time. They give money. They're well known in the community for how well they take care of the poor, but their home life is terrible. Their children are a mess because they're more concerned with what's going on out there. So those are the kind of things that I think about. And now yet he puts emphasis on these daughters and gives them specific names like Yamima, you know, which can mean warm, or one of the translations is turtle dove. The next one, Kizia, is usually associated with cassia or cinnamon. And then the last one, Keren Hapuch, actually relates to some form of vessel, like a horn or something that would keep like a makeup or a powder. So it's really speaking about the characteristics of these daughters, you know, one being warm like a turtle dove, the other one, you know, having an appealing, let's say, aroma, and then the other one having this, you know, rosy cheeked face or whatever. It just kind of speaks to the possibility that he's now sees the value of family, sees the value of children, and is getting more involved. Now, as it relates to the women receiving the inheritance, this is really interesting. You know, like you said, and where do we read about this? We read about this in Numbers chapter 27 with the daughters of Salafcha.
That's right. That's true.
And specifically verse 8. Where it talks about, and it says, "And speak to the children of Israel and say, if a man dies without leaving a son, you shall transfer his property to his daughter." This is after the daughters of Salafkad came. And then we read a further in Numbers chapter 36, where it goes on and speaks further about how an inheritance cannot be transferred from one tribe to another. So this could speak to what you were talking about, is his connection to Israel, is his connection to the people, and that even back then, if we make this older, obviously, than the Torah, because he was a man of God, because he was a man of faith, that God wanted there to be purity within that family, that that they would only, the inheritance would stay within Job's tribe, so to speak, and not be transferred to another people. Because typically, you only your sons inherited.
That's right. Yeah, so it's very curious. Okay, so that's a possibility. The final verse, Ira, we're there. Actually, you know what? There's two more.
Two more.
16. After this, Job lived, as you mentioned, 140 years and saw his children and grandchildren for four generations. And so, the final verse, Job died old and full of days. And the thing that I love about this, Ira, is that it seems to define old and full of days, that he lived 140 years. He saw his children and grandchildren to four generations. And there's a number of occasions in the Torah where we read that someone dies old and full of days. And I think one of them, correct me if I'm wrong, one of them is Abraham.
Yeah, so this is one of the verses why I brought up the possibility of him not necessarily being part of Israel. Because typically what you would see is that when somebody like this, you know, that was considered, you know, one of the great characters or like the patriarchs, it said that they would die and they would be gathered to their people or gathered to their forefathers or gathered to their fathers. And that doesn't appear with Job, which is why there's that, which is why there's speculation about that. Now, I agree with you that being a man of God and being a man of faith, and certainly he was considered a righteous man by God, certainly gave him, you know, position in God as it relates to what you're talking about. But that's the only reason I was bringing up, you know, the fact that, and that's a very significant point, especially for the listeners of your show, is that somebody doesn't necessarily have to be a physical descendant of Israel to be right before God.
True. It's
true. See that all through. We see that in the Tanakh. We see that in Yeshayahu in Isaiah 56.
So I'm just having a look. It is in Genesis 25 where it refers to refers to Abraham as it says that Abraham breathed his last. This is verse 8, and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Right. Old and full of years. Maybe it says that somewhere else, but it certainly says it once prophetically about Abraham, and then in verse 25, chapter 25, it fulfills that prophecy from what I think was Genesis 15:15.
Yeah, the same is spoken of David HaMelech, King David, in 1 Chronicles 23:1.
So when David was old and full of days, there it is, he made his son Solomon king over Israel. Beautiful. Okay. And so there it is, Ira, we're finished. That is the book of Job. And I guess in the end, can we say that he lived happily ever after?
Well, we can. I don't know that I'd want to go through what he went through to live happily ever after, but
it was certainly trying and somewhat horrific in many ways, but at least we have a happy ending. He did live happily ever after, and it speaks mightily of the sovereignty of God. The book of Job speaks mightily of the sovereignty of God.
Amen. And I think that's the point that God brought out, is that in that Job speaking rightly of him, you know, he spoke rightly of God's sovereignty. There's no question that throughout the book he very clearly spoke of God's sovereignty.
Now, let me ask you a question, taking that into consideration, that God, reflecting now on the book of Job, God does not answer Job's questions. He doesn't see that there's a need to answer Job's questions, but the emphasis at the end certainly is on his mighty power that is far beyond our comprehension, and his sovereignty, that he can do what he likes when he likes because he wants to. And the question becomes, for who was to benefit from this experience besides the reader, because we still obviously have the book and we still study it today. But at the time when this happened, for whose benefit was it?
You don't think it was for Job's benefit?
Well, you know, I think you could say that in the end, because as we just said, he lives happily ever after. But was it for the end result that it began? I'm gonna say something controversial.
Well, I mean, I think I've been saying something controversial all along, in that I have put Job in a position that most people don't like to put him in, and I've made the case that Job did not have a proper understanding about God, and he had a wrong attitude about who he was. When we talked several chapters ago about all the things that Job said he did, I've done this, I took care of the poor, I did this, I did that, I did the next thing. That's a terrible attitude to have, as if somehow righteous.
So I agree with you that the end result was a maturing and a teaching of Job, and that certainly was beneficial to him. There's no doubt about it. The question is, that was the end result. Did the exercise begin solely to benefit Job in such a way, when really so much pain and suffering was endured by Job in order to come to that point? And maybe that is the case, but I want to go back to chapter 2, and this may be a controversial thing, but what it says was, "And Yehovah said to Satan, the messenger, 'From where do you come?' And Satan answered Yehovah and said, 'Well, from going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it.' And Yehovah said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil?'" Now, is it far-fetched to say that it's all this whole exercise has also been to mature and teach Satan, this particular messenger?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that before you brought that up. And the reason why I say that is because I don't think it's just that. I think it also involves the friends. I think it also involves the brothers and sisters and all the friends that weren't there with him when he was in the garbage heap. I think it was meant to teach an overall lesson to the people of the time about who God really was.
That's true. That's a fair thing to say. But right from the get-go, right from the beginning, it begins as a conversation between Yehovah and Satan, and it begins what seems to be an opportunity to teach Satan something about the relationship between man and God.
Right. So I just want to be careful about that, and so I want to elaborate a little bit. When we talk about this, we still have to go back to something that you brought up earlier when we talked about messengers in general, okay? That messengers have a specific purpose, and that specific purpose is to fulfill the will of God, okay? Whatever it is that the purpose of God is, or the will of God is, that messenger fulfills. If we look at Satan, not again as the capital S Satan, who's an adversary of God, but yet instead a servant of God who has a specific purpose, and its specific purpose is for our testing, okay? In a way, and I'm just going to throw this out there, I'm not saying that there isn't specifically, there can't specifically be this malach, this messenger, but in a lot of ways, when you look at the esoteric teachings of Judaism, you know, this Satan, this adversary, is actually our yetzel, our inclination, our yetzer hara. You've heard me talk about the yetzer hara and the yetzer tov, good inclination and a bad inclination. So if we look at the Satan, and I'm not saying we have to look at it in that way, in the inclination, what I'm saying is let's say we do consider this a malach, okay, an actual physical messenger of God, and his specific purpose is to test us, okay, the way the Yetzer does, because we are tested by our inclination, okay? Then that would not be an unusual conversation for God to have with that messenger, because that messenger would want to, in a sense, to use modern-day terms, maybe push the envelope a little bit on what he's allowed to do. But at the end of the day, we still have to come to the realization that he's only allowed to do what God allows him to do.
So true. So true. So there's something else for the listeners to consider. Maybe I've gone a little far there. Maybe a little too controversial, but I think it's worth consideration.
I don't have a problem with perspectives. You know that? I bring up some wacky ones sometimes. So
yeah, there we go.
We got to do some maintenance here. You know, we may want to talk about this real quick before you sign off. Is two things. Number one, talking about potentially the next wacky perspectives that we'll bring from that other book. Do we want to tell them?
Do we? So the book that we have discussed, well, we haven't even discussed it yet, but we've floated the idea of possibly looking at sometime in the future. We don't know how long that'll be, but possibly looking at the book of Daniel. So if listeners would like us to do that, please leave a comment and let us know. But that's one option that we've floated that we may be doing sometime in the future.
Right. And if you want, and if you'll allow me my shameless plug for the night, since
please,
we don't know when we're going to be back on, I just want to let your listeners know that this Sunday, September 1st at 4 p.m., I will, along with my friend Rod Bryant, be launching a new radio show called Beyond the Matrix.
Beyond the Matrix.
For life and faith. We are going to get into very controversial subjects like we do here on the show. We're not just going to be talking about the Tanakh. We're going to be talking about geopolitical situations, the things that are going on in the world like we see today as it relates to Israel, as it relates to people of faith and the Jewish people. So that's this Sunday at 4 p.m., Sunday, September 1st. That's 4 p.m. Eastern time in the United States. And people can go to my website, TorahThreads.com, and it will be broadcast live on there. You'll see a little player on the side, on the right-hand side, that's called Spreaker, and it will broadcast live Beyond the Matrix at 4 p.m.
So TorahThreads.com is the website, and you can go there, and there are links for you to follow and become involved live as it's happening, Ira.
As it's happening,
Beyond the Matrix, and that's going to be ongoing, correct?
Yes, we're going to be doing that every Sunday at that time until further notice.
There you go, dear listeners. So although we have concluded our book Job, Ira will be continuing to do some teaching. And again, the Facebook page is also Torah Threads. There's also a Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page, but Torah Threads.
Actually, and there's a Beyond the Matrix Facebook page too.
There's even a Beyond the Matrix Facebook page, people, that you need to go to and like and engage there as well. But TorahThreads.com is the nice new shiny website that Ira has, and I encourage you to go there and get involved. Thank you, my friend, for giving us so much of your time. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you really have been so generous with your time in regards to the book of Job that we've just concluded. What a milestone.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, John.
Always a pleasure to have you, my friend. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.